information into software.
Sure. Yeah, so this is supposed to be informal, so please interrupt if you want me to give more detail or something. This talk is, I've kind of assembled in it in a less formal way, kind of strung together a bunch of different results. So it might be a bit jumpy, but hopefully it'll stimulate more discussion and go into more depth than you'd get in a normal talk. So that's as pretty as Drosophila gets, I guess. That's why I stole that slide from Sean Carroll. So with the completion of genomes, everybody suddenly realized that the real challenge is figuring out what it does, like how it works. In particular, you know, how much of it is functional? Where does that function map in the genome? And how does it all fit together to make something like a complex phenotypic trait, like an eyeball or something? How do you coordinate development and other phenotypes, development of any phenotype, really? And of particular interest to evolutionary genetics are really, given what we know about how the genome works and how it produces phenotypes, i.e. very little, we're interested in what kinds of changes underlie phenotypic differences we observe between individuals in a population or between populations or between species. And kind of nested in this endeavor are a set of sub-questions like to what extent does natural selection shape genome evolution? Really, that's analogous to this question up here, which is what fraction of the genome is functional, because natural selection acts on mutations that have functional importance. There's a controversy that's been going on for decades in the field of evolutionary genetics, weighing the extent to which divergence we observe between species at the molecular level is the product of genetic drift or natural selection, and so that's crucially embedded in these questions. And there's also been some debate about the nature of beneficial mutations. How common are they? What are the average sizes of the fitness effects that, or the fitness benefits that they confer? And basically how that ties into adaptive evolution and patterns of genome evolution in general. So that's the backdrop for this. So the talk's going to jump around just a little bit. First, I'm going to talk about using comparative genomic approaches to estimating the fraction of functional sites, and then discuss how those might be wrong. And then talk about emerging evidence that there's quite a bit of adaptive divergence in protein evolution, just because it's easier to show. Then the third part, which is going to be applying the same methods to non-coding DNA and showing that there are many of the same patterns. And then, depending on the amount of time I have, outlined a few directions in which I've kind of pushed this research and show you some preliminary results, really. So the most basic question is what fraction of the genome is functional? Where does that function map? So historically, the focus has been on proteins. That in Drosophila accounts for 18% of the genome, not a lot. But proteins were easier to study at first using biochemical techniques. In fact, we don't know what at least half of the proteins in the Drosophila genome do. But there have been even more limited studies of non-coding DNA. And these have been limited because they involve laborious direct functional studies. So we know little about the function of non-coding DNA. It's long assumed to have little or no function, just junk spacers in between genes. But it comprises the lion's share of the Drosophila genome, 82%, and even more of most eukaryotes. But this combination of the focus on proteins, I think, and these limited direct functional studies on non-coding DNA have left us with a canonical view of a gene that looks something like this. Basically, here we have exons that code for protein, untranslated transcribed regions at the beginning and at the end. And then we have these elements out here, which are called cis-regulatory modules. These bind various proteins and regulate how, where, and when a gene is expressed in coordination with other genes. Okay, but the thing I want you to get from this is that these cis-regulatory modules comprise the minority of bases in non-coding DNA, and they're highly clustered, modular, as a modular would imply. They're modular entities. So they're discrete modular entities that comprise just a small fraction of non-coding DNA. That's the canonical view. So,
a better view would really be, would include those, but then there are also regulatory elements that are non-modular. And those are very, perhaps not as well studied, a little more difficult to find the pieces that comprise a non-modular regulatory, but they are well known.
Right. Perhaps the emphasis on modular is that they're easier to study than those. So again, a bias really towards studying things that are easy at first, I guess. But so apart from these laborious direct functional studies, which I think are only now gaining speed with high throughput genomic techniques, the most widely used approach to map function in the genome has been a comparative genomics one. And basically, I mean, Dimitri talked a little bit about this. I'll just cover this very quickly. Basically, what you're doing is you're partitioning the genome into two parts, a functionally constrained fraction, C. This is functional DNA mutation at these sites are deleterious, and they're deleterious enough to be removed by natural selection, so you don't see them accumulating between species. Then you have this unconstrained portion. This is assumed to be mostly non-functional DNA, and mutations at these sites are assumed to be neutral, or at least not strongly selected enough such that genetic drift doesn't cause their fixation once in a while. And so right away you realize that, well, what about positively selected mutations? Because these are functional changes to non-coding DNA that are appearing in the unconstrained class. But partly for convenience, historical reasons, and maybe a bit of intuition about what we know about the average effect of a mutation, these are generally ignored. And I guess the most extreme viewpoint in that direction is Kimura, who's quite influential in the field. This is a quote from his 1983 book. It says, there's no doubt that these favorable mutations do occur in the genome, but essentially, even if, like comparative studies, we'll never be able to reveal them because they're just too rare.
Selection and unconstrained as opposed to constrained?
Yeah, because these will accumulate as differences between species. Okay, so the assumption here is that whatever is constrained is functional, whatever is unconstrained is not functional. Because it's allowed to accumulate because it's not deleterious. But the problem here is that you inherently assume that positive selection isn't causing the accumulation of mutations between species. So, is that okay?
Well, not really. I mean, look at, you know, consider histone or something where there's two amino acid differences between, you know, gene corn or whatever.
Right.
You know, those two substitutions may be adapted. So it's an extremely constrained protein. Those sites are extremely constrained. And the fact that they're so constrained when they have changed may be extremely dangerous. They must be adapting those species. But
All I'm claiming is that in that comparative genomics paradigm, this is what is assumed. In fact, I'm going to spend a large part of the talk challenging that. So I don't believe it by any means. So.
But I guess if there's no change, it cannot be adaptive, right? So to the extent that it's constrained and it's the same.
Yes. So the easiest way to show how a measure like this, or you might come up with a measure that would work, would be to look at different classes of sites in a protein coding region. So here are sequences from two species for a coding region that code for amino acids, and you have mutations that change the primary sequence of the protein. But these changes called synonymous sites change the codon that's used, but not the amino acid. And so you might think that these would have smaller phenotypic effects than the non-synonymous change. And you might actually use synonymous sites as a proxy for something pretty close to neutral. So the way you would do this is you would measure divergence between two species, for example, at synonymous sites and non-synonymous sites. This is some data for 35 coding regions in soft melanogaster. And essentially, you define this constraint fraction. The fraction of non-synonymous sites that are functionally important is 1 minus the amount of divergence you observe compared to the amount of divergence you expect. So this is the tricky part, how much divergence do you expect? I'm going to use synonymous sites as a proxy for that. If you assume synonymous sites are neutral, you would infer that 86.5% of amino acid sites are functional enough such that a deleterious mutation that occurs there will be removed by selection.
Question here. I don't know how much is a problem in Drosophila, but in mammals where you have hypermutable contexts, hypermutable contexts will be selectively maintained in non-synonymous sites, and less so in synonymous sites. So
perhaps
technically, neutral divergence would be underestimated by this way. So I don't know if in Drosophila there is variation context, variation of mutation rate.
So I think there's less context dependent mutation variation among contexts in Drosophila than in mammals, but I don't think that gets us off the hook, really. I think that the whole key here is that the divergence you expect. I don't think you can ever, because you're measuring at two different divergence at two different sites, I don't think you can ever guarantee that the mutation rate is just lower at the site that's slightly to the left. So the assumption here is that you're somehow capturing, you're somehow getting a good idea of how much divergence you expect. So it's a problem.
But you can probably do it in a clean way if loss of function mutations, for example, in this gene give you a visible phenotype, like autosomal disease in humans. So you can measure the number rate of mutation in functional sites. So I don't know if any.
That's right, but I think you're still extrapolating to sites where you don't have that information. So I'm going to attack this view anyway. I don't really believe that, but that's how constraint is measured. I think it does capture something about functional sites, the number of functional sites in proteins. And what
point of fact that particular codon glycine is a good example of, it's not exactly context dependent mutation, but those triplet G's are remarkably avoided in Drosophila, and it's the most underutilized codon of all the codons.
There is something going on with that. So, I mean, that's how you'd apply it to so protein. If you go back here, I mean, the bottom line is that non-synonymous sites evolve slower than synonymous sites, and the reason the cause that we infer is that most mutations to non-synonymous sites are deleterious.
How much do these estimates change if you also try this directly through the mouse?
Not very much. And part of the key to that is what we were discussing before, that you just don't see a lot of context-dependent mutation rate variation in Drosophila. Although you can detect it, we're talking about pretty minor.
Codon bias does change things, at least in yeast.
I know. So, okay, but 86.5, you know, it'll change it to 90. It won't change the conclusion, really. So
the ordering can change, like which gene is more constrained, which gene is less constrained.
Sure, that's right. Ordering is a whole other can of worms. But this is the approach that we all, you know, understand from proteins. But the same approach can be used to estimate levels of constraint in non-coding DNA. Here it becomes a little trickier. Because the sites at which you're getting your neutral proxy are even farther away from the sites where you want to measure the mutation rate. So this is what I worry about more. But this approach has been applied, you know, widely in comparative genomics. This is a paper by Casey Bergman, a student of Marty's in 2002. He's looking at pairwise alignments of Drosophila species that are quite diverged, actually, 10 million years, 30 million years, 40 million years. And then the last comparison here is to anopheles. This is a gene called Apteris in the Drosophila genome. And what's shown here is a similarity plot. So where you see these bumps, there's sequence similarity between these pairs of species, suggesting some sort of functional constraint in these regions. Because encouragingly, what you see is these islands of sequence similarity in a sea of lack of similarity. And that seems to confirm the intuition we had about how we think genes are regulated, and these direct functional studies that seem to show that regulatory elements are small discrete clusters. And in fact, Casey showed you that some of these enhancers, the enhancers of the Apteryx gene, actually co-localize with these conserved regions. That's encouraging. That's good news. Some don't, but these are, you can essentially test this in the lab, throw it in front of a reporter gene and try to see if it has some sort of function. So these are testable hypotheses. What I want to emphasize, though, is that these deep evolutionary comparison tests have not really overturned this view. Essentially, we see that the modules or these discrete entities that regulate gene expression, that's generally the model. And as approaches have become more sophisticated, though, over time, the fraction of non-coding DNA involved has been steadily increasing. And so I think Casey Bergman and Marty were being pretty radical when they suggested in 2001 that 17% of non-coding DNA in the genome was somehow functionally important. I think no one believed you, really. Probably. I didn't. just because you have mutation rate variation, you expect, if you line two genomes, you expect pieces to assemble by chance. And so it was unclear how much to what extent that was going on. But just 4 years later, Adam Siepel was using a multiple species alignment to estimate, to bring that number up to 32%. But yeah.
Adam Siepel's model is like an HMM.
Yeah.
So yeah. Are the states conserved and non-conserved, or can you have sort of intermediate levels of conservation?
The maximum they have 10 states.
Sorry?
I think the maximum they have 10 states.
And what are the states?
But they are by
levels of constraint.
Because it seems like these numbers the 17 and 32 could, even if you had exactly the same data, you might arrive at a different conclusion depending on what the states you're cataloging.
No, absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
But
no.
I don't think his method actually, looking at phylogeny, if a regulatory site crops up in some part of the tree, his method doesn't account for that at all.
Right, I see. So it requires it to be
uniform.
Right. And again, it's only a deleterious evolution model. Yeah. I think part of the key to this is that they're still comparing species that are quite diverged, like 10 million years. And I think that's too much time. I think that it's difficult to align these genomes when there's been so many changes. There's a lot of indels, for example, regions that you just don't know the alignment for. And I think This number jumps up again when you consider much more closely related species, and I'll show you two examples at least.
So, Pugh, do you think it's of any value to just kind of erect a straw man that every site in each software genome
is functional?
Yeah, under selection.
I don't see why not. Yeah. I don't see why not, because it's getting close.
But this is a testable hypothesis, because in human you can do direct estimation of mutation rate, and then you can compare it to what you see in human chimpanzee divergence. This is, at least in this sense, in terms of fixation probability, this is a final answer, right?
Yeah. I still don't think you're going to get there, because you're going to be able to make broad sweeping conclusions like I'm about to make. But when it comes down to deciding whether there's 90% or 98%, it's going to come down to very minute biases in how you. It's always like how much divergence do you expect, and that really limits what we can do. I think. Yeah.
So correctly, here the idea is still based on sort of bootstrapping. you are doing a genomic comparison, and then you identify what fractions conserve, and the coding part, right, you were able to just say, okay, so here's synonymous, here's not synonymous, and then you measure how much variation or constraint, how much less variation you're getting in non-synonymous. So the question, so I guess one way of getting at something like that would be if we had some reasonably good map of, say, answers in resolvable arrays, so people collect a bunch of transcription factor footprints, identify these little clusters, and then you just take whatever they found in resolvable, and you look at how close you can get to that enhancer, how much of it you can reconstruct in the simulants. And you get some measurement of how rigid the constraint is. But unfortunately, I think when people do this intensive bashing, they already put in the interspecies comparison as a bootstrap.
Right. I think what I'm about to show you is going to show that's not going to work very well. Because in general, I showed you in Casey's plot that when you compare very diverged species, you see these islands of similarities, and we presume those are enhancers. But a different picture is going to emerge when we move closer. Do you want to add?
Yeah, so I was going to say something about a comment that was made earlier about taking the total mutation rate, say you could do Drosophila resequencing, and you could just figure out from generation to generation what the de novo total mutation rate is. And then you could ask, well, is there more or less divergence than expected? But you still need a calibration point. I mean, that's the big problem for human chimps. The error in like the time to the most recent common ancestor of a human and the chimp sequence far outweighs other sort. I mean, we could get it wrong twofold easily.
Yeah, the question is 17% versus 100%. I do understand that there are many quantitative issues.
But 17% versus 32% is swamped by our error in when was Lanigaster and Drosophila and simulants actually split, right? Like even, I mean, it seems like in 5 years we could get an estimate of the mutation rate at every base pair in the Drosophila genome by sequencing a whole bunch of different generations of Drosophila.
Yeah.
The high full coverage, right? Yeah. But are you really going to learn from that?
But okay, but let's forget split. But if you do polymorphisms, if you have like percent range polymorphism rate in simulants, so sequence a lot of those, right? And you will see a lot of polymorphisms, and you can see frequency of new mutations versus frequency of polymorphism.
We're gonna get to that. You guys are way ahead. I just wanted to say that my main point so far is that there's a bias in estimating selective constraint. First of all, because we don't know what the mutation rate is. Second of all, we're biased because of what we can align. We can align what's conserved, and therein is a bias. So that improves when we use more closely related species. So the first place we started looking for this, and the first place I noticed it, because I was doing demography studies, I wanted to use neutral DNA, so I used these things, long introns, short pieces of long introns, assuming that they would be neutral. But what we found, the more introns we looked at, that introns come in kind of two flavors in the Drosophila genome. One half of introns in the Drosophila genome are less than 86 base pairs. That's just the median size. And for those introns, if you compare them to synonymous sites, they evolve at about the same rate, implying that there are very few constrained sites in there. In fact, you do see very little constraint, and it tends to be at the beginning, at the end of the sequence, required for proper splicing of the intron. But the other half of introns, we see a very different pattern. They have about half the divergence of synonymous sites. And even though this is only half the introns in the genome, it's 95% of the intronic DNA, and that's the equivalent of saying most people in lines are in long lines. So if you estimate this constraint fraction relative to synonymous sites, which may have its own problems, we estimated something like 40% of sites being constrained, and that's significantly higher than previous estimates. That was a paper I did with my postdoc, Penny Hadrill. And it was subsequently confirmed a year later by Halligan and Keatley, who compared the entire genomes of Drosophila melanogaster and Drosophila simians. Here, instead of measuring divergence on this axis, they're showing an estimate of constraint, which is just 1 minus this divergence ratio. What you see is that long introns are more constrained than short introns. And here they are marching into the intron from the 5' end and from the 3' end. You see the same pattern. And these high levels of constraint here are the splice sites.
In short introns, you just get to the edge, minus 40/50.
Where are we?
Yeah, short introns.
Yeah.
40/50, just basically it's not the middle of the short intron anymore.
Exactly. This is just as long as a. Yeah. There's a big piece of the long introns missing here. Because they vary in size.
Can I just get a clarification? Like, we could say something, you know, 40% or something like that.
Yeah.
Now, sometimes you're saying 40% of the sites are constrained. Is it equally fair to say that, to interpret it as all the sites are constrained and evolving at 40% of some ratio?
Yeah, I think the interpretation here is that at least 40% of the sites are functional.
I guess it's not.
Because under this paradigm, things are either functional and essentially lethal, or they're neutral. It's just the paradigm that's being used here. I mean, it's
a silly paradigm.
I think the problem of saying half sites 100% are functional evolving at half rate is that you condense the distribution of selection coefficients very narrowly around 1 over n e. So the mutation probability would be something very different from 0 and 1. Which is plausible, but it's a very narrow part of parameter space.
Yeah, I think the paradigm here is just there's strong selection.
Strong.
Okay. At least 40% of mutations that we should be observing, we didn't.
Okay, but that's, I think, what he's asking about mutation fractions.
Yeah.
But my point is, go into those long introns. No, actually, maybe there are some regulatory signals in there. But I'll bet even, you know, take 100 sites that you think represent that constrained class in long introns and look at a mutant and non-mutant version of those sites. And experimentally, I doubt in one of them you'll actually see a fitness difference.
Oh, that doesn't mean anything.
It doesn't mean anything, but you say strong selection, so I say, okay, do 100, and let's see at least one we can see. Now, maybe we can only see in an experiment selection down to...
Wait, but last week you were telling me that 2NS of 10 is, like, very strong selection. 2NS of 10 in Drosophila is an S of 10 to the minus 5.
Yeah, but...
So that would be the fitness division.
There was some work in humans where you looked at highly conserved regions and tried to estimate distribution of selection coefficients, and it seems that in those non-coding conserved regions, even though they are highly conserved, distribution of selective force is much weaker. Selection is much weaker than the coding regions, even if conservation level is the same.
Yeah, I think we're going to get to that. I mean, it's a limitation of this paradigm. Please help me get out of this paradigm. Because I'm a population geneticist. So I agree with you. I mean, much more can be done. But what we wanted to ask was, what about other types of non-coding DNA in the genome? Does that show the same pattern? Basically, I wanted to find something that looked vaguely neutral, that was not as short as a short intron. And so I went to intergenic regions, and they show the same constraint pattern. And UTRs, these are known to have some constraint, but if you measure the amount of constraint, there's like 60% fewer divergences than we expected, which seems much higher than we would predict. We know that there are little functional bits to 3' UTRs, little binding sites, for example, sometimes for microRNAs. But microRNAs are 20 base pairs long, let's say, and your average 3' UTR is 440 base pairs. So we're talking about, with 60% constraint, we're saying 2/3 of those sites have some important functional consequence. So it not what we expected to see. And so that was a close species comparison. Melanogaster and its closest relative, Simulans, they diverged less than 2 million years ago. So what we did was, together with Doris Bachtrog, we looked at some data for Pseudobscura and Miranda. This is a completely independent Drosophila comparison. And basically, you see that that's exactly the same pattern. Short introns evolve at the same rate as synonymous sites. Long introns evolve significantly slower. The constraint fraction is roughly about 50%, and the same pattern in intergenic regions. So all of these patterns are borne out in an independent species comparison.
Yeah, just a detail. Before, the short introns were being slower, and here it's slightly higher. Was it slower there before?
No, it's not significantly different than the synonymous.
Before it wasn't also?
We can go there. It's, you know, on the edge. But I actually think non-coding DNA and synonymous sites have different mutation rates.
When did these species split?
These two? About a million years ago. So.
Every time that we go to fly base, we bring back new exons, new splicing forms, new sets of overlapping genes. How these definitions of introns and constraint on the introns have been changed when you add what we know now, that many introns, basically the long introns, get either genes inside the
intron. Yeah. No. So I agree with you, and I that's what I originally thought. I thought, well, we're just hitting coding regions that we didn't know were there, or maybe RNA genes. But the key to this is in the variance among measurements of constraint, I think, because if you're hitting the odd exon, you expect a large variance. Sometimes you have very constrained sequence. Sometimes it's very unconstrained. But if we see a very uniform level of constraint, then something else is going on. So that constraint is high, but one key to testing this model is, are constrained nucleotides clustered or not clustered? Or similarly, are there unannotated bits that we're missing? That would fall out in this analysis thing. And so this is one way of showing you the answer. What I'm doing here is just, in melanogaster simulans comparisons, just sliding a 1 kb window across three different long introns. This one's 3 kilobases, this one's 13 kilobases, and this one's about 20 kilobases. Okay. And what you see as you slide this window measuring constraint in this 1 kb piece is that constraint is very eerily uniform. It doesn't bump up and down very much. There's the average, 50%, and you just kind of bounce around a little bit. So this shows a little bit more heterogeneity, but the least constrained window here is still 30%. Okay, so this is actually a very constrained intron.
How big is the window?
The window is still 1 kb for all of these. Okay, and that red bit right there actually is a gene on the other strand. And so just looking at levels of constraint, there's no way you would predict that there would be a gene there. You'd need other approaches. So constraint is eerily uniform, and in fact, that's borne out in whole genome comparisons. This is, again, from the Halligan and Keatley whole genome comparison of melanogaster and simulans. And here they are looking at constraint on this axis in intergenic regions as you march away from the gene in the 5' direction and away from the gene in the 3' direction. What you see is that here's the average level of constraint. They estimate 60% because they're using different neutral sites. They're actually using the interior of these really short introns. But the thing that strikes me about this is how little variance there is around that constraint estimate. So they're plotting here the 95% confidence interval on constraint. So, you know, 3 kilobases from the gene, constraint varies in 95% of the measurements of constraint. Varies between, you know, 0.59 and 0.61.
Is it a standard error?
What?
Is it standard error?
Right? No, these are 95% confidence intervals.
Can you go back to the previous slide? The window that you're analyzing is 1 kb.
Yeah, it's 1 kilobit.
But the average exon, for instance, is expected to be 300 bases, 350, and most likely the missing exons are even smaller. Maybe the window size should be.
Okay, so I'm not claiming that there's not heterogeneity at a smaller scale than 1 kilobase. But that's a huge departure from this canonical model here. It doesn't rule out some variation in constraint. In fact, Halligan and Keatley argue that there is significant evidence for variation in constraint here. But you see it on a very, very small scale. Like there's a slight excess of mutations that are close to one another within, I think it was like 10 or 20 base pairs. So there's micro variation in levels of constraint, it seems, but you can't detect anything on a larger scale.
But this is still very large scales. I mean, if you look, for example, in a single binding site.
20 base pairs?
Within 10 base pairs, you have, of course, near neutral rotation in changes that leave the energy the same. And
okay, yeah, I'll get to that.
Another base. So that's at a level of single bases, there are big variations.
All I was trying to say is that this view is wrong. That's all I wanted to say. I'm not trying to say that there isn't variation on a smaller scale. I was just trying to say that this view is wrong.
But I think also we should realize one thing. Some of these analyses were done, let's say, 3-4 years ago, and now we know the data showing there are exons.
Not enough.
The reality now is not in your favor that they were.
Not enough. It's not enough. And the appearance of exons don't change much necessarily. That's the other point. So I don't doubt what you're saying. Annotation is important. I agree.
Just slides correctly, should they have some sort of particular structure or not? I mean, is there any evidence of that?
Yes.
Because if you impose a given structure form on any region, the constraint is 50% plus or minus.
Because it's folding into some.
Well, because you know, once you pick the base of each.
I think that's
strand of a helix, then the other base is given, so it's half of the base that are.
Right, but not in these elaborate structures. Not every base is paired usually. But I take your point. I agree with you. I think that's a possibility. There's molecular biology evidence that if you remove genes, if you remove introns, it changes gene expression.
If there are good enough evidence that the intron structure is important, then the constraint, you know, it's essentially 50% plus or minus 5. It's
not sure how you get that number, but I agree that.
Well, it's, you know, you draw structure. That's the structure you want. Then you put the bases, and you realize that each time you pick the bases, you get the other one.
When you throw them into folding programs, you generally see that things like pairing more. But I think it's a very difficult field. I've stared at a lot.
I'm not sure I thought this through correctly, but it seems like ancestral polymorphism could lead you to, I mean, all these pseudo-Tura, Miranda, Mel, and Sid, they all share some ancestral polymorphism. I mean, ancestral polymorphism actually contributes to divergence, and it seems like that could lead you to underestimate
constraint. Yeah, I agree with you. But so we're underestimating constraint. Yeah.
I guess makes it worse.
Makes it worse. Just pointing out one more thing before we get to your point, which is that the pattern in Drosophila is opposite to mammals. That is that in mammals you see the proximal non-coding regions close to genes are more constrained than away, whereas in Drosophila you see the opposite pattern. So if anything, you see less constraint near genes where the regulatory elements are supposed to be. This doesn't make sense, right? So constraint is very uniform, shows the opposite pattern in mammals, but there is variation in constraint if you look at the right types of sites. This is the latest installment comparing 12 Drosophila genomes. Really, I think they only used a subset of 6 for these measurements. They're using the fastest evolving pieces of these short introns as the neutral reference. And they're measuring constraint in different classes of sites. These are actually fourfold synonymous sites. They're measuring something like 10% constraint. Here's non-coding DNA in general, comes out at 60%. But you can see in rich constraint in things that where you've mapped function by direct functional studies, like map cis regulatory models modules show significantly more constraint than your average non-coding DNA. These are DNA footprints, again from direct functional studies. These are predicted transcription factor binding sites, just purely computational prediction of transcription factor binding sites, show elevated levels of constraint.
So these predicted ones, they don't use constraint to predict?
They don't use constraint to predict it.
They use constraint to predict?
There might be some circularity there, huh?
Yeah.
I agree.
What is footprint
exactly?
Like
sort of, yeah. I mean, you bind the protein to DNA and then cross-link it to the sequence and then digest the DNA away that's not bound to the protein. Then you can deduce the sequence that was bound, basically.
DNA is one the same. So you got the DNA.
So that's encouraging because that something's making sense. It's this thing I think that doesn't make sense. Why is constraint so high in general?
So why is constraint 10% in the fourfold degenerate?
They're just evolving at 10% of the rate you'd predict based on these short introns. So either we have the mutation rate wrong.
90%.
What?
90%.
Oh, sorry. Sorry?
So why would that be?
Oh, why would that be? Codon bias. I'll show you some results on codon bias. So that whole previous approach is plagued, I think, by several assumptions. One of them is mutations are either essentially lethal or neutral. The other thing is that we have some idea of what the input of mutations is. I'm more confident about that when the sites you're measuring are intercalated with the ones that you're using as a reference, but I'm less sure about the inside of a long intron versus synonymous sites or a short intron 10 kb away. So these could easily have different mutation rates. So how do we rule out mutation rate as being the cause of all at least all of this pattern? As you were alluding to, you can use the population genetic approach, and I don't know who first did this, maybe Tajima, looking at the frequencies of transposable elements in natural populations versus other types of mutations. What he showed was that transposable elements are kept at lower frequencies than your average mutation, and the inference was that transposable elements are deleterious and they're being pushed out of the population by natural selection. So you can use that exact same approach, but instead of just using two sequences, one from each species, you need multiple sequences from one species, one of the species. And you see these polymorphic changes that are not fixed in the species. You can classify them based on whether they cause an amino acid change or not, or they occur in non-coding DNA. We can compare the frequencies of these different classes of sites. And so what I did was collected polymorphism data and combined it with some published data as well for a bunch of different classes of non-coding DNA sites, UTRs, introns, intergenic regions. Here are non-synonymous sites for 35 coding regions, and here are the synonymous sites. And instead of showing you the full frequency distribution for each mutation, I just lumped mutations into three classes: low frequency, which is frequency one out of, we have a sample size of 12 alleles, common, which is this intermediate range, and high frequency, which is frequency 11 out of 12. And so what you see is significant difference in the distribution of polymorphism frequencies for these different classes of sites. This is a fraction of sites falling into each category. In particular, you see, for example, synonymous sites compared to for low frequency compared to common. There are many fewer low frequency mutations than at non-synonymous sites, and actually all classes of non-coding DNA. So there's an excess of low frequency polymorphisms in all of these classes of DNA sites. And that's consistent with purifying selection acting on these sites and is independent confirmation that these sites exhibit constraint. And actually, you can compare these to population genetic simulations of selection. Here's the expected frequency distribution of polymorphism frequencies for neutrality. Here I've added a bit of positive selection and a bit of negative selection, and that's how it's expected to change the frequency spectrum. So basically, you can eyeball it. We can guess, you know, for your average non-synonymous polymorphism, what is 2NS, and it looks like 2NS is somewhere in the ballpark of -2 to -5.
What is thinking in terms of list population large enough so background selection wouldn't shift frequencies in synonymous size?
I think it could.
It could.
Yeah. One thing I didn't mention is that when I went to survey these fragments, I just mainly chose fragments that were in the highest recombining regions where there was no obvious evidence of recombination rate heterogeneity, to try to get away from this problem that variation in the intensity of selection due to variation in population size might influence this.
So demography couldn't explain this?
Well, it's demography could explain either an excess of rare mutations or an excess of common mutations very easily, but I think it's hard for demography alone to produce a skew at this class of sites, but no skew at that class of sites. You have to invoke selection on one of those classes of sites. So either the demography is negatively skewing everything in the genome and synonymous sites are under selection, or you have to assume that these represent something closer to neutrality, let's say, and these are under negative selection.
So in equating the right and the left.
I'm sorry?
I said in equating the right and the left, there are a bunch of assumptions about demography.
Jumping from here to here, there's a big assumption about demography. But under the simplest demographic model.
But as you say, your finding could confirm that synonymous. Oh, no.
You said that non-synonymous.
Okay.
So
either synonymous sites are in the strong selection.
Right.
Or demography plays an important role.
No, I'm saying that demography is a problem in interpreting this. But under the simplest demographic model, like a constant size population, you would say that these look like they're under negative selection. In fact, that's the model that's being simulated here. These are under weak negative selection, and these are closer to neutrality. Okay, but demography could change the direction of the selection inference there, but it won't change the fact that selection is operating. So you have to invoke selection. Demography alone can't produce this difference between classes of sites. So the reason I made this graph is because there's not much contention that your average amino acid polymorphism is under purifying selection. My point here is that it looks also like your average polymorphism in these non-coding DNA classes is experiencing the same model as non-synonymous sites.
Yeah. If you compare synonymous in genes with bias, with strong bias and without bias,
you will see. You do see something.
How those graphs are.
Yeah, it doesn't change very much. Actually, two slides.
I had another one. Maybe also two slides away, but if introns, because the most surprising, of course, is this non-coding DNA story. So if you stratify nucleotide as a non-coding DNA, like synonymous and non-synonymous, but by whether it's the same nucleotide between, say, simulans and melanogaster difference, so do you see difference in the distribution?
I haven't done that. But I know that that's successfully been used in humans to show that even sites in non-coding DNA in humans that look like they don't have lower divergence than you would predict under neutrality, they do show that this same signature of purifying selection. Astana et al. In a PNAS paper, and you were on that paper, yeah. That's the paper. So yes, demography sucks. So what do you do about it? We're going to, that's the recurring theme of my talk. Because what are you going to do about it? You go to different species that has some other random demography. Like Drosophila miranda, this is the study I did with Doris Bachtrog. We had polymorphism for Drosophila miranda for different classes of sites. What we see is exactly the same thing we see in Drosophila melanogaster, qualitatively. Actually, puzzlingly, replacement sites don't look like they're under very strong purifying selection. But it could be due to the small sample of genes that we were looking at.
Is this also a sample size of 12 chromosomes?
Yes. That's all the miranda that exists.
But we can have one more.
Yeah.
That does seem to be the rule, yeah.
It's the Kreitman rule.
Well, no.
Yeah, Marty started the
field by...
Not to insult anyone, but that was, you know, a bit before your study, so...
Yeah, yeah. There are reasons behind it. Let's not go into that detail.
25 years, we should celebrate that. Yeah.
What we did in a recent paper was we looked at polymorphism data from Drosophila simulans. And so, again, another random demography, in fact. And actually, I think what we see in Drosophila simulans is that when we look at synonymous sites and compare it to other sites, we see a negative skew everywhere. And that would seem to... Where did the demography guy go? Okay. That would imply some sort of when you see all sites affected by showing the same pattern, that implies that there's, you know, some demographic event that's affecting all the sites in the genome. But in fact, what we did was we teased apart mutations, and I'll talk about this a little more later, into different classes of synonymous site. Those there's codon bias in Drosophila, and some codons are preferred while others are not so preferred to be used in a protein. And so when you classify sites based on whether they cause a change in the level of preference for a codon, or here's an unpreferred codon to preferred, preferred to unpreferred, and I'm showing the neutral expectation here, all of these show a skew towards an excess of rares. That might be due to demography or even purifying selection on these classes, but some of these classes show more of a skew than others. So this is preferred to unpreferred. These are a priori deleterious mutations, and what we see is that they're more negatively skewed than the no change class. And so I think that we're sort of starting to tease apart effects of demography and very weak selection on synonymous sites here. I'll show more on that later. But basically, when you compare this no change class here to different classes of non-coding DNA and non-synonymous sites, you see a pattern that's exactly what we see in Drosophila melanogaster. And so, yes, demography is a problem, but it's not explaining what's going on here. I think the simplest hypothesis is that there's constraint in non-coding DNA, and you see it both in divergence and in the site frequency spectrum.
The PP and UU classes probably also has some constraint in there, most likely, because it's preferred and preferred classification is very crude.
Yes, I don't doubt it. I don't doubt it. And I'm not trying to say that these are neutral. I'm just trying to say that these have slighter phenotypic effects than these mutations. It's our best guess at the moment. Josep has done much more sophisticated stuff looking at hierarchies of codon usage. Then as you separate your synonymous sites into more and more classes, you lose statistical power as well. Oh, this is predicted under neutrality.
Constant population.
A constant population size of neutral mutations. And so even the no change class here has an excess of rares relative to neutrality.
It
could be demography.
But I think it's demography, or it could be very weak selection. But the point here is that there's a significant difference among these codon classes. And actually, when you compare these to these, you come to the conclusion that these are more negatively skewed than those. And that's most easily explained by purifying selection.
Thanks, Tony. You know, something that Joseph did some years ago, showing that codon bias correlates also with gene length. Long coding regions in Drosophila invariably have lower average codon bias than short genes. For short genes, some are weakly expressed and don't have codon bias, but on average they're more. But as you step through these size classes, the average just drops, you know, in a very regular way. What the reason is perhaps still controversial. Joseph will talk about that, I'm sure. But you get the impression that there is some distribution of selection coefficients, and there's some things, as you get to larger gene size, you may have more trouble maintaining codon bias, that some of them drop out, but not all. And some more drop out. But that there must be a distribution of selection coefficients on these bias.
No, no. By
small sites,
like in terms of splicing or
yes.
splicing and things like
yes. that. Yes. Yeah. And actually, they've shown in the folding of the, not only do introns fold like this, but the mature mRNAs fold up like this. And interactions between synonymous sites can influence rates of translation or actually the half-life of that.
Could that create edge effects as well?
We'll talk a little bit more about that. This sounds like it's USIP territory.
I mean, one of the reasons the GGG glycine codon is so avoided is because if there's a gene preceding it or after it, these four genes in a row can form these called G quartets, which create a knot-like structure in the RNA. It's difficult to translate here.
Okay. So the first conclusion, how long did that take? I think the easiest way to explain the patterns we've been seeing is that a large fraction of non-coding DNA in the genome is functional. And that radically changes this old view from modular cis-regulatory modules, essentially that are highly discrete and form just a minor fraction of non-coding DNA, to something that looks more like this. There are functional elements everywhere. We don't know how they work. They might not work as enhancers. They might work in splicing the intron or something like that. But the inference is that a new mutation to one of these functional sites will knock out that function and it's removed by natural selection. But there's actually a different possibility as well, and that is that this old view is kind of right. And these are the functional elements that regulate that gene. But these open circles here are maybe one or two steps away from a functional element that has the potential to regulate that gene. Okay, so we have a mutation here that creates a de novo regulatory element, and that's deleterious and removed by natural selection.
Is it a logical time to ask a general question? So this finding of yours suggests that your large genomic trait of deleterious mutation should be normal central zone. So how does this play into how the genetic load argument and all of this? Because people were writing papers that you may be 1, 2, 10, and what you're saying you is what, 100?
No, 2.
Still 2?
I think so, something like 2. Or 4 or something, but I don't really think the load arguments are a problem. I'm much more worried about that type of thing for the positive selection that I'm about to talk about. But in terms of when you do, I think that's a slightly bigger problem. If you calculate load, it doesn't turn out to be too bad.
How much work has been done? Like, I'm looking at this new view too of these potential sites. I mean, you might also view those as sites with a selection to avoid having a sequence that is functional. That is to say, you don't want transcription factors or various kind of proteins sitting down on those intervals. And once you start having kind of multiple overlapping constraints on what you don't want there, that can start piling up.
What?
It is your view.
That's exactly my view. And here's my favorite example. It's escaping me who did this work. It's a paper by Klopp et al. But what they're doing is they're trying to map to the nucleotide differences that genetic differences that explain the phenotypic difference between Texel sheep, which are prized for their muscular bodies, compared to comparatively wimpy sheep. And what they did was they mapped a single nucleotide change to the 3' UTR of the myostatin gene. And what they showed is that that creates a de novo binding site for two microRNAs that just happen to be highly expressed in skeletal tissue. And so these bind to the gene, they take out the myostatin gene, and muscle mass starts to grow, continues unregulated, basically. And so I think this is an example of the kind of thing we're talking about.
There's this paper in humans that you might know more about that came out recently where they found this, they found this through a whole bunch of different approach. They were trying to map the genetic basis of some disease, and it was in the Gila desert, and they did a whole bunch of different studies, and they figured out that this mutation was not even in a conserved region, actually. It was sort of in the middle of nowhere, and it turned out that they created some enhancer or something that suddenly started transcribing some gene and causes some really deleterious disease, and they kind of did all the biochemistry to figure out what's going on. But it's kind of exactly this example where there's one mutation away. You actually have several mutations that create that enhancer, and all of them create that or lead to that disease phenotype. So you have selection against sort of one mutation away from the current state.
And you think humans are more charismatic than these sheep?
No, I think second example. That's all.
Yeah. No. Yeah, that's good.
There are other pictures of sheep.
Yeah.
Charismatic.
So, some implications of this conclusion. Just some discussion points, maybe not for now or later, or when Josip gives his talk, is that all of these deleterious mutations imply there's lots of fuel for interference among mutations, and I think they're going to change things in how interference is modeled. Generally, models of interference look at selection on coding. Here we have a coding region, and it's embedded in some non-coding DNA, and you see some interference effects. The level of interference would look something like this. It's higher in the middle of a protein than outside. But if we're saying that all of this DNA out on the sides here is also subject to deleterious mutations, that could make things look a lot more even. So it's going to change how we think about modeling interference.
So one possibility, right? So these states are not doing anything important, right? But they're one step away. But if they're truly not doing anything, then you would expect them to be lost through deletion bias, right? So they must be doing something at least.
That's a very Dimitri thing to say. No, I agree with you. I think that's a very good point that goes towards what Marty was saying, this straw man about every site in the Drosophila genome potentially being functional, because Dimitri's shown in some of his work that there's a deletion bias in Drosophila, and if you take parameters that he's estimated and put it into a model where you have a genome of functional and non-functional sites, very, very quickly everything that's not functional just disappears.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
So it has a function. Yeah, it has a function in the spacing.
No, because we're talking about deleterious point mutations, so we're talking about functional, meaning that point mutation inside
I guess Peter's saying, let's say it's A right now, and it's not doing anything. And the reason there are deleterious mutations is that C would be bad. But A is not carrying any function. So you can lose it, right? Because
you can lose
it. Creating an enhancer or site. But you probably can't lose it.
You probably can't, because it's important for spacing, or it's doing something.
So your hypothesis, if we create fifth synthetic nucleotide and make spacers out of this fifth nucleotide, which wouldn't cause any enhancer or any possibility, then this would be an ideal situation, right?
I guess that's not what I was thinking.
And what do we know about selection on spacing? Yeah. Does anybody try to understand whether or not there is stabilizing selection for the space between different functional elements?
Not a lot. I mean, the only work I know of is Marty's work on even skip, really.
That's not spacing, right?
Yeah.
It's swapping.
No, but you can kind of see some regular.
A little bit of an attempt.
It would be super easy to do in the same framework that you have done for space, you know, quintons, right? Quintilative model. So it's the same idea.
Yeah. But the thing is that spacing does not explain the dearth of nucleotide point substitutions. So I don't doubt spacing is important, but it doesn't explain the constraint that as I've measured it and Keatley and Earwalker has measured it. And you can measure constraint based on the number of deletions. It's a bit more complicated. But
if you do soft left, you know, the genome is probably very compact. Everyone would agree.
But you know, I think if you have an important functional base in, say, every 10 base pairs, then the bases in between will be protected. Mm-hmm. So deletion rate through very small deletion is not that high. So you could have some kind of a
correlation.
Yeah.
You see that in the plot that you showed before when you said, well, this doesn't look uniform way back before. And you could see the lag. There's definitely a dependency along focal bed.
Yeah, no.
Here, this is not independent.
That's not real, yeah.
Oh,
these are overlapping windows. So there's some autocorrelation in the windows.
Yeah, that's because there's a.
Yeah.
Not independent.
But if you, just in your mind's eye, like filter out every 10th window. do that experiment. You guys can't do that? If you did that, you see the same pattern. It just looks prettier this way. But yes, you're right.
Yeah.
It doesn't jump up and down very much. Someone had a question back there.
How would you explain the Pleiadian genome size of C times smaller than ancestor?
Who?
Arabidopsis Pleiadiana.
It's 3 times smaller?
Than ancestor.
Deletion bias.
Good answer.
In accordance with your worldview, it could be such, right?
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, Mike Eisen has some really nice results some coming out of Mike Eisen's lab. What they did was they looked at the even-skipped enhancers in Drosophila that have about double the genome size of melanogaster. And it's really cool. You see all of the elements. It's very well-characterized enhancer. You see all the elements there, but in the species with the large genome size, these binding sites are spaced out, whereas in melanogaster, they overlap with one another. So these sites can move around. And if, you know, look at E. coli. There's tons of overlapping stuff. So I think they just, like, merge.
But then the picture you present is melanogaster-specific.
No.
All those constraints would be much more sparsely positioned in other bigger genomes, right? So melanogaster
a little
is
bit.
The most compact you can envision,
yeah.
Right?
But another way you could think about this is that, you know, how many sites do you need to make a melanogaster? The number of functional sites in non-coding DNA is not going to be different by very much, right? Oh, yeah. I was just saying that if you count up the number of functional sites, an interesting back-of-the-envelope calculation, count up how many functional sites we think there are in non-coding DNA in the Drosophila genome, and it's roughly the same amount that that you see in the human genome based on levels of constraint in the human genome, even though the genomes are 10 times different in size. There are more in the human genome, but it's on the same order. So I think we're learning something about the number of functional sites you need to make a fly.
So I think I'm going to ask something later. So I'm just puzzled that the constraint is on long introns and not short introns.
Yeah.
Do you want to say that somehow short introns are so short that you can't make an enhancer out of them?
Yes. But yeah. So actually, wait. But a short intron has GT, and then like a couple of bases, and then it has this bit in the middle, which is about 23 bases. That's the fastest evolving bit, and then there's a track of pyrimidines here, and then AG. So basically, everything here and here is required for splicing. So basically, what you have to play with in these short introns is 23 base pairs. I think, yeah, it could be hard to make an enhancer. You can make a transcription factor binding site, but an enhancer is usually a collection of those things. And so I think that's an argument for why these things. The thing I don't really understand is why do medium-sized introns show less constraint than really long introns, than really, really long introns?
So a related question was, so how does the distribution of intron size compare between fly and man?
And human? Yeah, so in Drosophila, half of them are these minimal introns, and in humans, there's that distribution is way skewed towards being much larger. I don't know what the average intron size is in humans. Anybody?
But really, humans is kind of bimodal.
Sorry? It's bimodal?
Yeah, bimodal. You get the short, that are longer than the Drosophila.
The short ones are a little longer than the short ones in Drosophila.
Yeah, but there's no way in Drosophila, half of introns are this size, and that's not true in humans. Yeah.
But humans have a really long tail.
They have a really long tail to it. Okay.
So functional region in humans, in non-coding regions in humans, are they evenly distributed, or how are they?
Yeah, no. In humans, you see much more of this something that looks like the old view clustering model. It looks like enhancers are modular, and there are bits in the middle that look fairly neutral.
So they have to cluster towards regulatory regions, the introns.
You see them everywhere, yeah.
Even in intergenic regions.
You see them in intergenic regions, yeah.
Clustered.
Yeah, you can see them anywhere, but he also has this paper that I was talking about before, where they looked at the frequency spectrum and they actually see evidence for weak selection kind of interspersed in between these highly constrained sequences as well. So.
And the density is at 50,000.
Yeah, so surprisingly, it's probably less than the other paper after that one. We just looked at the code regions. You have 22 mammals alive, right? And if you look at nucleotides which are conserved in 22 mammals by some measure, and outside of any conserved regions, any in concert, no, nothing, like Rudy Giuliani say, nada, right? So you take those and you come collapse them together, and they show every single signature of selection you can think about. And they are totally evenly distributed along the whole thing. So I think we probably have the same story in humans as your story, but in...
Yeah, but you don't see it in the divergence record so much. You see it...
You cannot find it in any window-based measure. You have to look at individual nucleotide, because in humans, synonymous sites actually evolve not faster, but slower than non-coding DNA if you remove CpGs. Yeah. So that's the whole different story.
There's also, I think, I mean, I don't know more about this, but I think that the fact that people have found this using HMM, so you need a string of conserved things before you can call something as conserved.
Right, right.
If your element is such that it has a bunch of conserved sites and then some not degenerate sites and then a bunch of conserved ones, you don't have enough information. You're essentially pooling information across sites
right. Before
your algorithm can call the block as conserved.
So that's a limitation of the Siepel method, for example, but not his method where it's much more.
But it's a reason why it might not show up in divergence, because if you have interdigitated kind of constraint followed by unconstrained sites, those don't get called necessarily get called as a conserved element.
Yeah. So how are we doing for time?
So we can take a break now. It's 11:15, something.
I ended with this conclusion. One of the discussion points was that there's a lot of deleterious mutations out there. That implies that there's lots of fuel for Hill-Robertson interference. But what I'm going to talk about now is that what we're inferring here is that there's a large number of functional sites in non-coding DNA. And we've been mainly thinking about that in terms of this deluge of deleterious mutations. But it also implies that it's a potentially large target for beneficial mutations. If a piece of DNA can have a deleterious mutation, it can have a beneficial one, right? So I think the big step here is realizing that there are a lot of functional sites. And it's just kind of a natural step, I think, then to think about how beneficial mutations might be accumulating at these functional sites. Something that a lot of people find, I think, heretical for some reason, but I don't really know why. And going back to this example, I talked about this in terms of deleterious mutations, and in fact, if this mutation arose in a naturally occurring population, it would most likely be deleterious. But as Darwin pointed out, I mean, these are sheep breeders. They're positively selecting this mutation, so it's beneficial for the sheep to have this mutation. And if sheep breeders can use this type of mutation, then so can natural selection in the right environment. So there's two sides to the coin, and using the comparative genomics paradigm, we were throwing positive selection in, we had to throw it basically out with the bathwater because we didn't have a way of getting at it using comparative genomics approaches. And this is positively selected unconstrained sites are functional divergence between species. I mean, these are mutations that evolutionary biologists care about. And so we'd like to learn more about those types of sites. But to say something about what fraction of the divergence between species is subject to positive selection, or is the product of positive selection, we have to use more than just comparing two species at the level of the number of fixed differences between them. But we need polymorphism from at least one of the species. And so this is the same example I've been showing. And here we have our old friend, the frequency distribution of mutations for a coding region. Some of them are synonymous, which are probably less functional than non-synonymous changes. And we can classify sites as being diverged or between species or polymorphic within a species. And so to think about this is to think of the trajectory of mutations, different classes of mutations over time. And so if you have negatively selected mutations, essentially if you look over long periods of time, essentially what you see is that there are many, many deleterious mutations that arise. And actually most of those are lost by genetic drift very early on. Once in a while a deleterious mutation will escape and drift to intermediate frequencies, but it's pretty much destined to be lost. Once in a while, rarely, a deleterious mutation will escape natural selection and go to fixation between species, but that will be a fairly rare event. The thing of most deleterious mutations that reach intermediate frequencies is that they'll eventually be lost. Okay, so that's what negative selection will look like over time. Here we have frequency. For neutral mutations, we understand this behavior very well. It looks similar, but there's nothing preventing these mutations from going to fixation. Most newly arising neutral mutations are lost by genetic drift initially, but they also fix at some regular interval, and we know the timing, the expected time of these fixations. Positive selection is going to look somewhat different. Again, same graph. Most positively selected mutations arise, and they're kind of counterintuitively, they're also lost. The bulk of them are lost, but with probability 2s, roughly, they'll escape from this and then very quickly go to fixation. And so the point here, though, is that they're rare, so they only arise once in a while. Okay. And so, here we go. And so what we're doing here actually is that we're observing this process at some random point in time, essentially, like right here. Okay. We're looking into a population and looking at polymorphisms, and then that's the polymorphism that we're seeing. These are positively selected mutations. We're seeing polymorphisms along this axis, And then we can, by comparing to another species, we can count the number of divergences by looking in the divergence record. So we can count the number of mutations that are fixing over time. And so Marty's insight was that essentially if you, and Dimitri talked about this as well, that under neutrality you'll have some sort of, some of these are lost, you'll have some sort of characteristic ratio of polymorphism to divergence. So in this case, we're looking along this axis. These numbers are very small. But here we count 1, 2 polymorphisms, 3 polymorphisms. So, and that if we look back in time, we have 1, 2 divergent sites. So the divergence polymorphism ratio is 2/3 for neutral sites. So we can compare that to some class of sites that we don't think are neutral and look at this polymorphism ratio. If sites are under negative selection, what we see here are 1, 2 polymorphisms, but only 1 fixed difference. So 2/1. So the ratio is increasing that way. And in this case, what we see here is 1 polymorphism and 2 divergences. Oops.
Okay, I need one more
joke. Oh, sorry. So under these different very simple models of the changes in frequency of mutations, you get these different predictions for the divergence to polymorphism ratio for different classes of sites. So by comparing these ratios, you can infer what the direction of selection is, and in more sophisticated approaches, perhaps the average intensity of selection or how frequent beneficial or deleterious mutations are. And so here's an example of how you would do this, comparing coding regions, for example. And here I'm going to assume neutrality and for non-synonymous sites. What I mean by that is not actually neutrality, but as Dimitri discussed, some fraction of non-synonymous sites changes are neutral. And we'll call it that fraction F, let's say. Whereas the other fraction, 1 minus F, are essentially lethal. So you never observe them. So conditioning on observing a polymorphic or divergent site for non-synonymous sites, the assumption we're going to start off with is that conditional on observing them, they're neutral. So if these conditional on observing them are neutral and synonymous sites are neutral, we expect those ratios to be exactly the same. Okay. And so if the divergence to polymorphism ratio, If the divergence to polymorphism ratio is 1.9 for synonymous sites, we expect the same for selected sites. But what various people have noted in Drosophila, and in particular Fay et al. 2002 and Smith and Earwalker in 2002 in back-to-back Nature papers, is that there's actually a divergence excess at non-synonymous sites. So non-synonymous sites are constrained, so they evolve slower than expected, but there's still a divergence excess relative to the amount of polymorphism that you see, assuming the framework of this model. And so where we'd expect this ratio to be 1.9, we actually see 5 divergences for every polymorphism. And that's what I mean by divergence excess. You can actually convert that into a measure called alpha, which measures the divergence excess. What this is saying is for alpha 50% is that 50% of the divergence you're seeing, you're inferring to be driven by a model that looks like this, positive selection. Yeah?
So this estimate should be conservative, right? Because there's also some deleterious polymorphism. Do you have any estimates like how conservative?
Yeah. Well, I'll get into that. I wouldn't call it conservative. I would call it an approach. I would call it, I'm going to discuss like some problem. We can get into a whole discussion about factors that would make this estimate wrong in both directions. Okay? So we're going to get into that.
And I think Joseph may talk about some additional ones.
Yeah.
I guess what bothers me every time I look at the DP ratio is, and that, you know, it's a beautiful illustration in your other pictures. Of course, it is proportional to the time. So, you know, that ratio has the units of time.
Oh, yeah. But that's, why is that a problem?
Well, because ultimately, to interpret that number, we have to know how far the two...
Not really, because you're comparing, you'd compare these...
Time
is going to be exactly the same for
well,
these...
That's right. So ultimately, we're going to take the ratios.
Yes.
Okay. But which sort of suggests that to begin with, right. one well, should be forming a ratio between the two Ds right. and two Ps.
Right. You don't actually do this. I only do this for convenience of getting some intuition or whatever. But yeah, I think what you're saying is D over P of 5 means nothing.
Yeah.
I agree with you. And that's why it only means something when you compare it to that number. And so actually, to get at what you're saying, actually what you're doing is you're using this to tell you about time.
D would actually mean something. That's what I'm getting.
P over P is F naught and D over D is, right? You're saying P over P is F naught.
Yeah. But,
it has a meaning.
But it's very not powerful. Very...
Well, yeah. we can still, you know, multiply and divide them, right, to get to the comparison. But yeah. But it just sort of seems to me that something is hiding in this. So ultimately,
there's a lot hiding here. Yes. Yeah. No, I agree. Yeah. But the thought, you know, I showed you what we can do with D over D, and it has its problems.
I don't think that's why. I think it's just how you have four numbers here,
yeah.
and how you represent them. Some ratios have biological meaning, and some ratios don't. And so it's just how you represent them, how you talk about them. That's just, I think that's the criticism.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not that there's anything wrong with it.
Well, when you come up with a...
I don't understand exactly the problem with units, though. So what you're saying is that given a certain time of divergence, this amount of polymorphism would be converted into such amount of divergence. So it's true that if you...
Listen, I'm only making a very curmudgeonly remark here. You know, just looking at number 5, it means strictly nothing to me. Right?
No, it should. That's why I converted into this.
But compared to that, it means something, but by itself, it means nothing.
This model, it populations as a reversion step.
It's a trivial question.
I mean, the point is, the same thing that Carol is one of those parts, so you could present it in terms of two other ratios.
Yeah, I know. I've explained this to a lot of students or whatever, and for me, it's hard to explain it outside of this kind of framework. This is not how it's done. But if you're worried about time, essentially, what's going on here?
I'm not worried.
Okay.
Now that we're going to take the ratio, it's just that I find that picture is wonderful, right?
Yeah.
But also that picture immediately sort of suggests that one should be looking at ratios of D's and ratios of P's and doing whatever one wants to do with it. But ultimately, the question is, you want to compare these things with different type of selection.
Yeah.
Right. And what's happening is we are using a proxy, right? We don't know what selection is, so we're using a proxy.
Yeah.
But still, just in terms of units, one thing is that this thing, I don't think, I'm wondering if it really has units of time, because polymorphism you could look at as essentially there's the time to the coalescent. Whereas divergence is the time to the common ancestor, so it's basically taking the ratio of the size of two trees. So in that sense, I don't know if that helps make it a better defined entity.
Well, that's sort of why I don't like looking at it that way, because I don't even know how to make it precisely defined. But this picture tells all, right? So if we were to run it 3 meters to the left, we would have arrived at a very different ratio. That's all I have to say.
Yeah, no, because the time continues on this axis too.
Precisely.
That's right.
Okay.
So, and
you're saying evolution only happened once?
No, just it's better. You're saying better represent is two P's, P over P and D over D, rather than D over P and D over P.
You know what? Whatever helps you, I think. whatever helps. Okay, but so whether you look at these two ratios or any ratios you want, you see that there's something wrong with this table. And the way you fix it is you suggest you invoke a positive selection model, and you say there's a divergence excess due to positive selection, and 50% of the divergence is driven by positive selection, and that's good enough for nature. So so actually, what you can do is you have the total number of amino acid substitutions, right? And you know what fraction of them were subject to positive selection. And if you count those up in the Drosophila genome, you estimate something like 250,000 adaptive amino acid substitutions in less than 2 million years. That comes out to one adaptive amino acid substitution every 20 years. So we're talking about quite a pace of adaptive evolution.
Yeah, and there are 13,000 genes, right? So you end up with...
Yeah, there are 13,000 genes, so that's more than one adaptive substitution, so on average. Okay.
This is what's restricted to coding regions.
This is just coding regions, right? And this is not my work at all.
I mean, so 20 adaptive substitutions per gene, not just one.
Yeah. A lot. The problem is that there are problems with the McDonald-Kreitman test, and. This goes back to the overall arching theme of this talk, which is demography sucks. That is that, well, to do this procedure of comparing ratios, you actually need some sort of neutral reference. And if you have a bad one, that can bias the test. So in particular, Marty drew this diagram. So problem number one is choice of neutral sites. And these are neutral sites, let's say, here. And this is the expected ratio of sites, essentially. This graph looks like something like this for the number of divergences you observe between species, and this for the number of polymorphisms. And this is to NF.
The other way around?
What?
The other way around?
I'm sorry. Yeah. Okay. And so this approach is assuming that your neutral sites are picked from this point here. We just set that arbitrarily to one. But if you invoke a negative selection on these neutral sites that you've chosen, like synonymous sites are under purifying selection, let's say, what this does is it increases the polymorphism to the divergence ratio, because it decreases divergence faster than it decreases polymorphism. And so because you are upsetting this ratio, even though the expectation is one under neutrality, you end up with biased estimates of the fraction of divergence. And the same goes for if you also distort your interpretation if you've chosen things that are positively selected.
I'm sorry to return to my point, but on this level, I think it becomes a little bit important what exactly we compare, right? Because we have to do the significance test. And again, if we compare D to P, we're comparing apples to oranges. But if you compare the the ratios of how much stuff is fixated in one region versus the other.
I thought we talked about that approach in the first hour of this talk, and I don't see how it was very productive in telling you anything, because you have no idea what the mutation rate is. So that's the whole problem here, is that with the comparative genomics approach, is that you don't have a handle on the mutation rate.
Maybe it would be useful to write down the formula for alpha and just see that you're dividing these by these and these by these, or just write down the...
Yeah, okay. I mean, so you make a table, I've only said, okay, here you have your non-synonymous sites and your synonymous sites. and then you have polymorphism to divergence. So I've put things in terms of, you know, the ratio of D to P for two different classes of sites, but if you want to see it as the ratio of P to P for two different classes of sites and D to D for two different classes of sites.
I think so, because then if you think about effects of demographics, for example.
Oh, okay, let me do what he suggested, though. Take it one step further.
It's a ratio of ratios, right? Either way, I'm a little puzzled.
I hope you can see this. Maybe I should. I want to save some room. That's the problem. What is it going to be?
Pn over Ps.
Over Ps. So this is how alpha is actually calculated. And you can swap these if you want. There's no difference because it's just taken, just summarizing information in this table. So the fault is in how I presented it, not, I think, in the statistics of the approach.
But I guess it's fair to say that the power of this, if any, is in the ds to dn part, because the pn to the ps part is dominated by the low frequency.
You can argue that?
It would only be significantly different from one if there were a difference, say, in the basic mutation ratio. So it's corrects for that. But so it makes this independence of the mutation rate. But if that is true, then the power comes from the ds over the n part.
Yeah.
Maybe that was Boris' point. I don't know.
I don't think that was his point. But.
But the thing you didn't explain, and this also may speak this a little bit for us, part of the idea behind this in John's argument, is actually you're looking at two categories of sites, synonymous and non-synonymous. And in principle, those can have different genealogies. And by chance, one might be deeper, one might be something like that. But in this specific test, compared synonymous and non-synonymous, they're really interdigitated.
Well, precisely.
And that the true. Hope is that kind of cancels out the fact that they're correlates the genealogies, which may shift as you move along the gene, but constantly cancel. If it were not that, then there would be a bigger problem.
I have a small technical question. So this figure one, I think it was called, or is it infinite number of sites? And is this a solid assumption that there's alpha lot? Or it is not infinite number of sites?
Well, that's a very qualitative graph.
Okay.
So
if we assume remutations, multiple remutations, not...
Yeah. Remember, divergence, I'm assuming you have two different species where, yes, infinite sites, essentially. The number of divergences is small. The number of polymorphisms is small.
Because those are ratios, actually. Boris ratios, they're D over D and P over P.
Boris ratios. Call them Boris ratios.
Right, because there's it's one and zero. Sorry.
Yeah.
Maybe I have another concern. So somehow we would like to find a positive selected size of some sort of gain of a tail, distributed tail, sites that are very similar. But now if you just draw at random, you know, with the given statistics of your genome, polymorphism and divergence, you're bound to have a tail.
Yeah.
So you're bound to have positive looking like signs, although you know by construction that they are not. So I was wondering, how do you take this into account?
Yes.
It doesn't seem so.
No, you do. You do. I mean, the assumption in under this test, as Marty suggested, is that all of these sites share the same genealogy. But it's actually because replacement sites and synonymous sites are intercalated with one another, it's actually robust to different parts of the protein having different genealogies because there are enough synonymous sites to capture the same genealogies as represented by the non-synonymous polymorphisms. Yes?
So were you asking about
individual genes?
No, I'm asking about the distribution. You know, you're trying to find the rare sites that are positively selected. But now imagine that you just give me the distribution of polymorphism and versions observed. And now I just make with this sort of rules a random genome.
Yeah.
So I know that it's random. Okay.
Yes.
But you're bound to find a tail, nevertheless. So you're bound. You'll find signs that look like positively related, but just by chance.
There's pooling here. Right. There's pooling across types of sites.
No, that doesn't matter.
Also, I think there are two issues here. One is that the methods you're describing don't actually have a model. They just take it some statistic and plot a distribution and look at the tail. Here you actually are comparing your putatively adapted sites to a neutral control, which is calibrated for that particular gene. And then the second consideration is just multiple tests. And there, you know, sure, if you look at 1,000 genes, then you have to, you know, somehow take into account the fact that you've done this 1,000 times, so you wouldn't want to just say whatever is, you know, you false discovery rate or whatever you want. But here you have a model, so you have a way of controlling the false positive rate or the false discovery rate. Some of these empirical approaches where you just look at the distribution of some test statistic don't have a model, so there you don't really know how to correct for the problem that you described of just not knowing what's in the tail by chance and what's in the tail for a reason. But I think this type of approach is based on an underlying model.
Right.
Could it be that you're thinking about these scans for selection? Is that the case?
My worry is that you're looking for very rare events and very rare events by chance also.
I guess the confusion is where are the rare events in this formulation?
You're trying to point
out that's the one with a very biased ratio of the
event. Yeah, but they're not driven by rare events, they're driven by the total.
But even if they were driven by rare events, if your model's correct, you could just calibrate it.
Yeah, but also it's not just the outliers, right? There's no outlier searching here.
There's no outlier searching. Maybe that will help streamline things. We're trying to estimate a quantity, some mean quantity. In particular, there's alpha here, and it's not sensitive to what you're talking about noise around the.
It's not located on the.
Yeah.
Just summing up.
I see.
You can use this to identify genes that have been experiencing, and they have their own problems. But as Molly mentioned, there's an underlying model. So it turns out that in most cases, as long as the assumptions of you know a single genealogy are met or the sites are evenly intercalated, you're not going to reject the null model here more than 5% of the time. Remember, that's how you've constructed your test. And if you don't believe it, what you can do is just simulate the neutral model and apply this procedure, which I have, and in fact, it's an okay test. We've checked that. But the purpose of what I'm doing here is trying to estimate this quantity alpha, what fraction of divergence was driven by positive selection, specifically. Okay, I mean, so getting back to kind of what the choice of neutral sites matters. I mean, it matters because it's going to bias your estimate of alpha. But then there are demographic effects, and these come in two different flavors. First of all, there's a problem when you're comparing two different species with different population sizes, because part of the divergence between species polymorphism in the ancestral population. So let me draw that out. So what we have here is divergence between two species. That looks like this. Now I've rooted it here with an outgroup. Okay, so I know how many divergences are on this side, how many divergences are on this side. And then I've sampled polymorphism within one species. The problem is that this branch length here and this branch length here are the same. Okay, that's the assumption that's going on here. That's true because this is the neutral model, is the null model. And under neutrality, that's what we expect. And that would be true if these species had different population sizes as well, under the neutral model. Because if this population here had a larger population, it would just look like that. It doesn't change the overall distance from here to here. Yes? The problem that comes in is when these sites are under weak selection. So what's going on here is that the intensity of selection is scaled by 2n, and the quantity that matters is 2ns. So what can happen if this species has a larger population size, all of a sudden these sites are experiencing more selection. Okay? If they're experiencing more selection, maybe I should have kept that. What will happen, and I'm still sampling polymorphism and divergence in the same way, they're experiencing more selection. What happens is that divergence on this branch is retarded because selection is slowing down divergence. But let's say these mutations are neutral in this species. And so now you have the problem that you're if these are your neutral sites and these essentially if you're comparing two classes of sites, what you would infer is a divergence excess in this class of sites, even though the only thing that's going on here is our deleterious mutations and a difference in population size.
So when your neutral standard has more slightly deleterious ones than the functional class.
That's right.
For this to be a problem, the population sizes have to be different?
For this specifically to be a problem, yes. Because if the population sizes weren't different, these essentially would cancel each other out.
Because they're likely to be.
So the approach that's been proposed here is, well, let's forget about this branch. That's one way of doing it. You can reconstruct this ancestor with an outgroup and just look at divergence and polymorphism that's just in this species branch. That takes care of the problem of different population sizes in the two species to some extent. The other thing that could be done is that you could just sample polymorphism in the larger species. And that would probably take care of it as well.
So why does it solve the problem?
So sampling polymorphism in the larger species?
The first one. Why does it solve any problem at all?
Because the problem here is that divergence is accumulating too slowly in this one species because it has a larger population size. And so all I'm saying is that assuming that this population has had the same population size since the ancestor, which you might have, is going to be my very next point. This takes care of the different population sizes in different species, especially recent differences in population size.
But wouldn't it be accumulating too slowly in that species as well?
In this species as well?
Yeah, I mean, I'm
mainly thinking about the ratios here.
Yeah.
I could draw this tree. Here's. This is what the number of divergences looks like when selection becomes stronger, right? The tree looks shorter. It's not actually shorter, but it looks shorter.
What? That's your neutral standard, right? That's the neutral standard.
Well, what you're using as a neutral standard, yeah.
And then the functional.
This is what you're using as a neutral standard. Okay. Like for example, let me make it more concrete.
But you have to look at
these are synonymous sites, okay, and these are short introns. Okay. That's more concrete now, okay? If synonymous sites are under purifying selection of some kind, you expect this asymmetry on the tree because these species have different population sizes.
Yeah, but you would not be comparing, let's say if the left branch is shorter for the synonymous than the left branch for the short introns, is still the same problem. I just don't understand.
No, the it's the ratio. You're comparing the ratios.
That's right. So the ratio there could also be different, could be affected by the fact that there are more slightly deleterious ones than synonymous ones.
Okay, but that's this problem.
Yeah.
No, I think he's assuming that in the species to the left, things are neutral.
Yeah.
The species to the right, they become equally deleterious.
Oh, right. Sorry.
Okay, I'm sorry, yeah.
But then the left branch shouldn't change. No? I mean, in size.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I guess my point would be...
You have some fraction that are lethal and the rest are neutral.
But
in this class, you have the same fraction are lethal and then some fraction are weakly deleterious, let's say.
You know, but the likely situation is that they're slightly deleterious ones on gold branches, just to a different extent.
I agree. I'm trying to very qualitatively describe a problem.
I see.
I don't understand why is this a big problem for neutral standard, because in your non-synonymous size, there should be some proportional size with selection coefficients between 1 over n and 1, say, in one branch, and 1 over n2.
Yeah.
And all of those, the divergence for those will be also depleted.
No, I agree with you, but what I'm saying is that your class of sites, this class of sites here is my test class. I want to know if there's positive selection in my test class. I'm telling you right now that there's no positive selection in this test class. But there is purifying selection in synonymous sites. And so what if I compare synonymous sites to my neutral class, in this case, I conclude that there's a divergence excess for this class, i.e. positive selection here, even though it's neutrality and there's purifying selection there.
And for weakly deleterious in non-synonymous, you don't care because this is conservative assumption, right?
Yes. So
okay.
Yeah, that's right. And so, yeah, then we can argue to what extent, you know, your test class is neutral. But all I'm saying is that if it is neutral, this situation creates a problem. This is a worry, qualitatively a worry. And it's slightly distinct from this point.
So I keep coming back to this thing, because, you know, what the remark that Martin made, you know, is very, very much to the point. The reason you want to compare synonymous and non-synonymous, they're really next to each other, and they've gone through all the same bottlenecks, et cetera, et cetera. And now if I just look at your expression for alpha, you know, clearly we can write it, in two different ways at different ratios, and it's exactly the same. However, if I try to estimate the error on that number by estimating an error of Pn versus over Ps,
yep,
and Ds over Dn,
yep,
I'm doing one calculation, and if I'm trying to estimate the error by calculating the error of D over T and D over P, I'll be estimating a very, very different error. Right? In particular, since D over P depends on time, right away, my error is going to be dominated by the error in the estimate of time.
Okay.
And
but
time is like n.
Can I just say something? I'm not talking about error. I'm not talking about like looking at the tails of a distribution. What we want to know is this quantity.
I'm talking about the tails.
What?
I'm talking about the variance. I mean, just any notion of significance. And the question is...
Oh, okay.
So the point is that...
Yes. No, you're right.
When we estimate error on the ratio, right, errors add up. They don't cancel, right?
Yes.
But if you take a ratio differently and estimate, try to... ask sort of a different question. Ask sort of comparing polymorphism on the neutral two types of sites, right? Sites with different selection, and ask what is a significant difference in the strength of selection that I can deduce on the basis of having measured so many polymorphisms.
Okay.
Right? But that's a very different kind of...
Okay, hold on. All of your problems that you're saying go away if you assume that there's no recombination.
I don't know if all the problems go away. Some problems go away.
Essentially, you're not going to be misled as long as these two classes of sites share the same genealogy.
Yeah.
Okay, and then it's actually also true that if the number of sites that you sample becomes larger and these sites are independent, they have independent genealogies from one another, you're also going to be okay. The problem that you're saying, which is a true problem and a concern, is when you have intermediate levels of recombination, you have like slightly different trees, for example, in one part of the sequence versus the other, then you run into a problem with this ratio. I wasn't claiming there's not problems with this ratio. It turns out that the ratio is not biased when that's the case. But the error increases, and I have some slides like that I would probably get to by tomorrow, showing that, that's a problem, and it's particularly a problem when you want to detect positive selection in non-coding DNA, because you're comparing sites that, aren't intercalated with one another, okay? So I agree with you, it's a problem.
I guess the question can be formulated in a very simple way. How unbiased your estimator is?
Yeah, not very. Okay, so the, so this was one
problem of demography, but there's a group problem. That's the thing, is that we can argue about minor problems, and then by the time you you think you have a handle
on one problem, another problem rears its head. This is a more serious problem, I think, because as people were alluding to, you know, here I'm assuming the population size is the same for this species along this branch and the same for this species along that branch. But that actually might not be true, and here let me put the ratio the way, the Boris ratio, okay? This is the ratio of whatever you want, polymorphism to, no, polymorphism to polymorphism or divergence to divergence, okay? And then there's some mean over time, okay? This is time here. And so what happens is that because population size changes over time, that this ratio can go up, and it can go down, and it can go up, and it can go down, like that. And if we look back in time, this is the polymorphism part, and this is the divergence part. Okay? And so this is a more serious problem, because what you're saying is that the ratio of polymorphisms in the present somehow have something to do with the average of that ratio in the divergence record. And that might not be the case, simply because of the change in population size. And so what's going on here, actually, this population is getting smaller as we go up, and the population is getting larger as we go down on this graph, because selection is becoming more efficient here and less efficient up here. So this can be a huge, this is a huge problem for biasing this estimate. And it very much matters if the current population size is smaller than the average or if it's larger than the average. And that's the problem that I really can't do anything about.
Yeah, well, I don't know, but intuitively it looks like you can prove that the model with no selection, huge selection, no selection, huge selection would give you a low limit estimate. So you can try to simulate this scenario and get a floor.
Yeah. Apart from drawing this cartoon, very little progress has been made on that. But I mean, I think.
You should be crazy to run such a simulation.
Agreed.
The other thing is that here we are discussing mutation rates that we can cancel with polymorphism to divergence. Divergence time, the point with the divergence time is that we are not using years for generations in the formulas. We are using divergence times in population time units. We are changing the population size in some ways, taking into account when we use the divergent time in terms of.
I don't think.
Units of populations.
I don't think so, actually.
Because that's why it's so important to analyze sites that are basically close to each other.
No, that doesn't get around that problem. That third thing doesn't get around that problem. I mean, the implicit assumption here is, in the calculating this ratio, is that this doesn't happen. It doesn't matter if your sites are intercalated or anything.
So one way you could see this is if you write, instead of alpha, you look at the number of adaptive substitutions you had. So you just multiply this formula for alpha by dn over here. Okay, and then you have alpha times dn, which is the number of adaptations, equals to dn, minus what you're subtracting from dn should be the neutral component of the non-synonymous substitutions. And then what you have there is you have pn over ps, which is estimating which fraction of the non-synonymous mutations are neutral. And then you multiply it by ds because you're assuming that that fraction which is neutral evolves at the neutral rate of adaptation. But what you see is that you're estimating that the fraction of non-synonymous to synonymous polymorphisms is capturing the fraction of non-synonymous mutations which are behaving neutrally. Now this measure is going to be, and that you're evaluating based on polymorphism, based on extent population size. So now if you go back in time and you have dramatic changes in the effective population size, then that would be considered reflow.
Okay, let's try to, yeah?
I have one more specific question, sorry. Populations shrink for reasons, right?
What's that, change for reasons?
Right.
Yes.
Which means that if your population goes down tenfold, it means that probably 90% of individuals are selected out, right? And the rest of individuals are selected for. So this negative outer correlation between population types.
I guess, unless...
And intensity of selection, would it matter at all or not?
I think it matters. I mean, there's a difference between the model you just described and just like a comet hitting the Earth, right?
Right.
So.
But again, intensity of selection is something well, reasonably well understood by quantitative genetics at least, right? And changes probabilities of fixation associated with it. And intensity of selection varies very much along your graph.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know really how to evaluate.
So intensity of selection is reasonably well understood by quantitative genetics.
I was going to let that go. I was going to say, okay, even if it was.
We might be speaking about, we might have different implicit ideas about what intensity of selection is, right? Intensity of selection is just proportion of selected individuals, like deviation of the group of selected individuals in comparison to standard deviation. That's it. In quantitative genetics.
I have to think about that more. I haven't really thought about that in quantitative genetics terms. Okay, what? I'm just going to move forward, though. We talk more about this. I mean, the point I wanted to make with this is that there are problems with the McDonald-Kreitman test, and you know, I might be able to do something about this because I might pick a different class of neutral sites. Let's say short introns might be good, for example. And then I might be able to do something about this because I can reconstruct the ancestor and look at lineage-specific stuff. The thing is that by the time I'm here, I'm like, okay, I'm throwing up my hands and saying, well, how much do we know? Like, how much can we trust this estimate of alpha? I told you alpha is 50% for amino acids. And it implies one adaptive amino acid substitution for every 20 years.
Three assumes that there's a functional size, right? So the proportion of selected filter is what changes, right?
Yes, yeah.
So if short introns are truly neutral, then it will not have any effect.
No, but you'll have the problem with the X class as well.
Yeah, it's the X class here. That's right. I'm assuming here that you've successfully actually found some neutral sites. You still have a problem.
So that's at the functional site you have the problem.
Yeah, it's intensity of selection at the functional sites. And so the thing is, as Dimitri outlined, if this adaptive evolution of amino acids is so rampant, we should be able to see some other kind of signature of it. And so what I did was I took a medium-sized collection of genes and looked for signatures of positive selection that are not dependent on McDonald-Kreitman test, but rather dependent on the effect of an adaptive substitution on linked neutral variants. And so if you look at, I surveyed 137 regions across the X chromosome of Drosophila melanogaster, and if you look at levels of divergence to Drosophila simulans, what you see is that some genes have more amino acid divergence, others have close to none. Some class of these genes actually has no substitution. If adaptive substitutions are really so common, you might expect that to have a detectable effect on linked neutral sites in these fragments. And so how I would outline that would be something like this. Imagine this white bar here represents position along the coding protein coding gene, and this blue field here is the expected level of neutral diversity across that gene. Okay? And this is a gene here that has no amino acid substitutions. So even if half of those were adaptive, half of zero is zero, and essentially what you see is you have neutral diversity at this gene because there were no adaptive substitutions. However, at this gene here, at this class of genes here, there were some amino acid substitutions. If some fraction of those were advantageous, Here, I've shown 50%. There are two amino acid substitutions. This one was advantageous. What happens is it will leave this selective sweep signature in this field of neutral diversity. So what's happening here is that when this amino acid substitution goes to fixation, it sweeps away linked neutral variability in a pattern that looks something like this. And so if we look at average diversity in a gene like this versus a gene like this, we expect diversity to be lower. We go further out under the tail, even more adaptive amino acid substitutions. This neutral field of diversity might look like this. Here's a gene with 10 substitutions. 5 of them were advantageous. And these sweeps occurred at different times and had different strengths of selection. But in general, what has happened is that diversity is average levels of diversity in this gene are even lower than here and lower than here. So we expect this a correlation between levels of linked neutral diversity and the rate of amino acid evolution if some fraction of amino acid substitutions is advantageous. Unless, of course, there's some sort of negative correlation between the number of substitutions and the number of beneficial substitutions. And so for these 137 coding regions, I surveyed amino acid divergence. I also surveyed polymorphism at these genes. And this shows synonymous polymorphism as a function of amino acid divergence. And what you see here is that genes that evolve rapidly at the amino acid level have reduced diversity relative to genes that have lower rates of amino acid evolution, which is consistent with this model that essentially you have more selective sweeps or more frequent selective sweeps at these genes. Or another way of thinking, you can think about it two ways. There are more selective sweeps at these genes, or the time to the last selective sweep is more recent in the past. Okay.
So this plot is it very similar to what you did in some extent?
Yes.
It's a different scale.
It's a different scale. So I should mention that these fragments that I'm surveying are just 600 to 800 base pairs long. They represent a single exon.
It doesn't matter because genes are not the same length. We count number of differences. We don't do it per site, and it's also a different scale.
How does counting the differences make? I mean, I'm just. It doesn't matter. All of these regions are roughly the same size, so you could just. Oh, okay, yeah. So you could just, if you multiply this out by the number of sites, you would get.
Like in humans, it makes a huge difference. I mean, functional density varies a lot.
Okay.
So just to make sure I understand what's happening. So you're not saying that there are many amino acid substitutions, and this is why pi for synonymous would be low. What you're saying, if there are many amino acid substitutions, pi has a chance to be very recent. So the sweep would be recent enough, so it would affect synonymous pi. Is this correct interpretation of what?
Here, the white things are very recent selective sweeps.
Okay, yeah. So.
And the darker blue things are older selective sweeps. So both things are true, that that this gene has had a selective sweep more recently in the past, on average than this. Mm-hmm. I could have drawn this better. I mean, and it's also true that this has been subject to more selective sweeps, and so.
What recurrent selective sweeps? I may recall this incorrectly. So there are those genetics papers by Gillespie with genetic drift.
Yes.
And I thought the main conclusion is that most of statistics we look at under genetic drift model are similar to what would you expect under drift model, basically. So these things wouldn't change your...
Well, any changes. On his model, any changes become smaller, so theta becomes smaller.
Theta becomes smaller, right?
Yeah. So that's...
Oh, yeah. Okay. So this is comparative to...
One implication of this is that if you look at regions of the genome with rapidly evolving proteins, they look like they have a smaller effective population size than regions that have are more slowly evolving at the amino acid level.
Yeah, sorry.
I think this pattern is consistent with a recurrent selective sweep model where you would have some fraction... potentially a large fraction of amino acids subject to positive selection. The goal would be to try to estimate some sort of parameters, like how frequent is adaptive evolution and how strong are these selective substitutions. And so there's some theory developed by V and Stefan in 1993, where they came up with some sort of a formula that looks like this, that the pi that you estimate at a particular gene is approximately equal to the recombination rate times theta over plus k 2ns. And then, okay, so little r here is the recombination rate per base pair. Theta here is the neutral mutation rate before selective sweeps, so for any times mu. K is a constant, which is approximately 0.075. This is the intensity of positive selection. It's the selection coefficient scaled by the effective population size. And this is the rate of selective sweeps. And so, for example, this has been used to look at in Drosophila melanogaster. You see this correlation between levels of diversity and recombination rate. And so this has been used to estimate selection parameters based on that correlation. Here I wanted to do something different, but because of what's going on here is I surveyed all of these regions from uniform, or I think uniform, and quite high recombination. So it's not recombination rate that should be varying among these genes, but rather I'm going to put forward that it's the rate of selective sweeps that's varying among these genes. And so I can use this exact same formula to estimate that parameter instead of understanding a relationship with recombination rate. Okay. The problem is, how do I relate this rate of adaptive substitution to Ka, because it's Ka that I'm actually measuring. So what I'm going to assume is that some constant fraction of amino acid substitutions are beneficial. So that's independent of the number of amino acid substitutions. I'm going to say the fraction is constant. So in this example here, alpha is constant. Here, it's always half of the substitutions.
There's another thing I'm struggling here a little bit. So for McDonald driving ratio, what you presented, what is different, how you call substitution adaptive, is the fixation probability is higher. So this equation will depend also on fixation rate, so how strong is selection, not just whether selection is present or absent. So why alpha is sufficient, because the rate of the time to fixation also should be in the equation, or I'm wrong.
It is in the equation, so
there's 2ns.
Oh, okay, yeah.
That's the intensity of selection.
Right.
Okay. So what I'm going to assume is that some constant fraction alpha of amino acid substitutions is beneficial, and then that scale to how much time has accumulated between melanogaster and semino. That's the speciation time, and then two branches. Okay. And so if I substitute that in there, I come up with something that looks like this. R theta over R plus what I'll call K prime. A compound parameter, alpha times S, and then Ka, which is what I observe, essentially. So I'm assuming some sort of model that looks like that. In practice, what I did was I employed a maximum likelihood approach, which fits each of these point estimates of pi under a model of recurrent selective sweeps, assuming that the rate of evolution is assuming that the rate of selective sweeps is given by a constant times this compound parameter times Ka. Okay, and what I can do is generate a likelihood surface for this is the neutral mutation rate here on this axis, and this is this compound parameter alpha S. So with the problem here, okay, well, let's just go with the maximum likelihood estimate here is something on the order of 10 to the minus 5, and theta is 0.031. That means that the true theta is something like that, and the average theta is given by this dotted line. So diversity, I infer that diversity is reduced by about 15 to 20% below the neutral model, which is similar to what Dimitri and Guy estimated in Drosophila simulans using a different approach. The tricky part is trying to uncouple alpha and s. And so I wasn't able to do that with this data set. Perhaps it was too small. Perhaps I haven't tried every technique. But I think what I can conclude, though, is that this estimated ratio of alpha times s here, 6 times 10 to the minus 6, constrains is constrained basically, or and is linked to what you infer the fraction of adaptive divergence to be. So this bar here is the 95% confidence interval, and this is the point estimate of alpha as inferred by the McDonald-Kreitman test. And so if we think alpha is 0.5, if we think 50% of divergence was driven by positive selection, that would infer imply an average selection coefficient of 10 to the minus 5. So with population sizes on the order of about a million or 2 million in Drosophila monogaster, we're talking about 2 NS of 20 to 40.
When I look at this, I didn't read this, is very new to me. So when I read this 50% of fraction of adaptive divergence, it means that you very quickly put better immune assets in place in 50% of sites. So it looks like very quickly you will make your genome ideal genome.
It's a fraction, it's not.
Unless the environment changes.
So there should be shift in adaptive landscape.
There could be, yeah. But the thing is, so let's say we think the McDonald-Kreitman test is bad or biased or something like that. You're still quite constrained as to what you can say F is. Okay, I mean, especially on this tail here. If you assume that 100% of the divergence that you see at proteins is driven by positive selection, that only changes the selection coefficient from here to here. So it's like not a big change. It's still very weak. It's still very weak selection. Even weaker, but there's a boundary here. It can't get any weaker than that. Okay, so that's one tail. This is the tail that we worry about more. Okay, because now what do you want to believe alpha is? So if you think alpha is 10%, it would imply a selection coefficient of 10 to the minus 4. And here, just to show you, here's the Dimitri and Guy's estimate, 0.01. I think what that implies then is that alpha is very, very small, like less than 1%. That's what my estimate implies. And so we've had some sort of
all of them have the same selection coefficient.
And all under this model, they all have the same selection coefficient. So this doesn't allow for a distribution of selective effects. But I mean, what this points to is some sort of discord between the estimate that Guy and Dimitri got for Drosophila simulans. They were looking at a large genomic scale, whereas I'm looking at the scale of individual exons and coming up with a much weaker estimate of selection if you believe that alpha is somehow larger than negligible.
I think because our alpha s is the same, right? So it's not that there's any kind of discord because of the...
Well, it's an order of magnitude smaller.
Is it?
Yeah.
Your alpha times s?
I thought two days ago you were saying that it's not.
Well, it's within it's smaller, but it's like within an order of magnitude.
Yeah.
In order.
Which one is smaller?
But theta is decreased by about the same amount, right? So
15 to 20%.
Yeah, but this is if yours is an order of magnitude smaller, it means it is that fraction of the events that takes place at high s, and then maybe the bulk of the events taking place at lower s.
Right.
And
which was my next line. Which is my next line is that perhaps you can reconcile the two by proposing that, what I'm seeing here is just very small selection coefficients because they're only measurable on very small physical scales given the recombination rate, And what they're estimating are things on the tail, which are more rare, but stronger.
I think there's a real discrepancy. It's just a complementary method.
And wouldn't you then?
They might be complementary, but it'd be nice to put them closer together.
I agree. So discrepancies sound just too negative.
Talking about the frequency of selective sweeps, I think you had already the pretty high number, 1 every 1,000 generation.
It's 20 times lower. Our rate was 20
right.
times lower.
So if you assume alpha is 0.5 here, it would imply 1 every 200 generations, roughly.
Shouldn't this be then observable in the fly population? I mean, 200 generations, how many years?
Genome life?
Yeah, somewhere in the whole genome. Somewhere.
I mean, it's not being observable.
So, what about selection on standing variation as a way of contributing to divergence that you pick up in McDonald Crichton, but that doesn't necessarily
right.
signatures and polymorphism data?
Who made that point? It was either Dimitri or Guy or both of you.
If that were a substantial fraction of events, then presumably it could lead to much higher estimates of alpha and McDonald brightness than you'd get from polymorphism data.
Sorry, standing variation meaning at the time of the split of the two species?
No, I meant, if selection routinely acts on, say, alleles that were previously neutral, then those might not have a big effect on polymorphism data and not go into estimates such as the ones that Guy and Dimitri obtained, but they would still contribute, potentially they would still go fast enough to contribute to alpha estimated from the McDonald Crichton. I mean, I don't know that anybody's looked at that explicitly, but it seems like a way of reconciling, even if selection could potentially be pretty strong under
yeah.
the regime if it's common enough.
I'm back, because you promised to come back to the genetic load argument right here, because it looks like there are so many selective sweeps and cost of evolving would be too high. So is there any idea how to reconcile this with the old theory?
Alex Kondrachov has a paper. it's hilarious because he published it in 1984, just after Kimura came out with his book, saying, this is the all of the evidence for the neutral theory. And meanwhile, there's this crazy Russian thinking about models like this, essentially where you have a huge number of selective sweeps just churning over the genome, and whether this cost of selection argument is a real a worry or not. And what he came up with is a model that where if you have a changing environment, like the key to the cost of selection argument is that you don't have to pay right away, that there's a lag. And there are situations where the environment can change on a time scale such that you never pay. You never pay the cost of selection. So,
what you're saying, environment with this many events, can we think that genomic it can be mutations in another place on the genome? So the source of this changing in the landscape may not be actual change in the environment, but change in your genetics with respect to a given environment. Is this a fair model, or it's? If I'm clear, I don't know. So what I'm saying, the environment like migration or differences in food supply versus other mutations in the genome which change your adaptation to some specific situation which you're in place right now.
Right. Yeah, I don't know.
Environment has to change. I mean, something has to respond to the environment or something, right? Because then, if not, then eventually everything's going to get to.
Yeah, but if I have positive mutations somewhere in the genome, but it's pleiotropic.
Oh, that's what you're talking about, a pleiotropic model.
No, initially I have no positive fixations, right? So I have first mutation, and I change it because of something, but it has pleiotropic effect on my adaptation to something else.
I'm just saying that the first one has to be responding to the environment, and then the other ones can respond to the first one, just kind of compensatory things. But the environment has to be triggering something, it seems.
So how much time is there left?
Minus hour and a half.
But it's fair to say that this question of load is still an open issue.
Yeah, no, I think it's an open issue. But
what is the question in the first place for me?
If you think about what's required in fixing a beneficial mutation arises in a population. what that implies when it goes to fixation is that everybody who doesn't have to have that mutation has to die. And there's a limit to how far you can take that, because you can only kill 1 minus 1 over 2n of the population ever, like on a limited rate, essentially. So that's called the cost of natural selection argument, and it's something that Haldane proposed. And Kimura used this argument to defend the neutral theory and said, well, this is not a problem if most of what you see at the molecular level is neutral and advantageous mutations are so rare that you barely observe them. The cost of selection argument went away. But then meanwhile, I mean, that didn't jive very well with people studying phenotypic traits, for example, who saw plenty of evidence for natural selection in the wild, and the implication is that there's some underlying genetic basis for this rapid evolution. So the debate continues, but until this new evidence from Drosophila, from the McDonald-Kreitman test, and from these hitchhiking patterns, really I think that's causing us to reevaluate the cost of natural selection argument, whether it's a problem or not.
If you could come back for a sec to the previous picture. So the question is, how many times do you have to change environment to fix bunch of those guys for which selection coefficient is something like
it's very small.
Minus 5?
Yeah.
And what should be the dimensionality of your environment to explain 10,000 or 20,000 fixations over a million of years?
You know, but you can have, let's say, change temperature every 10,000 years. And the protein, like you have one change that changes some km relative to temperature, then another one has to compensate for the fact that the protein now, you know, folds differently, and then you change again, right? So if you have environment change a particular time scale, it can be a fairly simple change.
Again, there is again some understanding accomplished for how fast you, how much selection response will you get out of given distribution of mutational effects. And what we are saying is that you can have like 1,000 mutations of very small effect contributing to selection response. It is not what we usually see. We see quite a distribution of mutational effects, but substantial fraction of selection response happens by big players. I just simply don't know how meaningful would be that little tail. So it is really about different environments, not about tons of alleles.
By selection response, though, you're talking about what you can detect.
That's clear.
Yeah. So maybe you can't detect.
Right. Like, it's an average what contributes to the McDonald-Kreitman table, not what contributes to the trait.
I'm not arguing that I understand something. I merely don't understand.
Yeah. What the implications are.
Numbers are consistent.
Yeah.
If you just play with numbers in a very superficial way.
And pick up on Dimitri's argument about actually protein biophysics, because I think this evolution in the window of stability is much more important than any function, because there is no mutation target for functional site is very small. And what we did with simulants data, you can split all your non-synonymous sites, but whether you're inside protein, outside protein, have hydrogen bond, don't have hydrogen bond, all of the stuff. And at least the long Kreitman thing changes a lot, but not like several fold, not like if you look at everything which is outside you, your KKS estimates would be positive at some point. So from biophysically imagining this huge mutation target for things which are responsive,
so are we?
Yes, I don't know where we're at. It's getting close to 1 o'clock. So how much more material do you?
An hour. I'm serious.
Let's meet in the second half of the day.
No. Yeah, no. I can. I know, depending on who you have scheduled or whatever, I could give the rest of it some other time. Or I don't have to.
Europe tomorrow.
Yeah.
You don't want to talk to
someone? No.
But how about a 5-minute executive summary, and then we can harass you in private?
Okay.
Good idea.
Right. So where were we? I mean, the first conclusion is that there's a lot of large fraction of non-coding genome is functionally important. Adaptive evolution seems to be common, and we can detect these hitchhiking signatures. I think there's some debate as to what alpha is, but I think it's the data is entirely consistent with alpha being reasonably large. So the reason perhaps why, there's a whole debate that centers around what's going on in proteins. What I thought in 2004 was, well, essentially you could apply the same approaches to non-coding DNA. Originally, the idea was that to apply the McDonald-Kreitman test to sites that we thought were neutral so that we would have some sort of baseline on which to judge the amino acid evidence. The thing is that then all of these constraints, this evidence for constraint was coming out in the non-coding genome. So if non-coding DNA is really densely packed with functional or potentially functional sites, then it's a considerably large target for adaptive substitutions. And in fact, I showed you an example of something that a substitution that could be adaptive in the right context. So the idea was to apply this McDonald-Kreitman test to different classes of non-coding DNA, the same ones I measured constraint in, again using the same two species, polymorphism from Drosophila melanogaster. And essentially it boils down to comparing these ratios, which we have a problem with. But this gives you the general picture that this is what we saw for amino acids. I can recapitulate that pattern in my data. But the interesting thing is that you see this kind of divergence excess kind of, it seems to be uniformly like or ubiquitous across the genome, including all sorts of classes of non-coding sites. But perhaps most convincing of all are these untranslated transcribed regions. And the reason why I find this kind of compelling is because those are the ones that are predicted to be the most densely packed with functional sites. So they show about almost as much constraint as coding regions, and they show almost as much adaptive turnover. So it kind of didn't seem too heretical in my mind. What is slightly more heretical and up for debate is this a weaker signal of the same divergence excess in just randomly chosen pieces of non-coding DNA. I don't think it... So. What you can do with these ratios is, again, estimate alpha for different classes of sites. And you come up with estimates of alpha that look like this. Again, the most interesting part of this, I think, is that in untranslated transcribed regions, you infer roughly the same fraction of divergence excess that you observe at coding regions. And you see less, but in introns and intergenic regions. And so if you add this all up, I mean, what this implies is that constraint gives you a pretty biased view of the Drosophila genome in terms of functional sites if you believe these estimates of alpha. Because even though all of these sites show slower evolution because they're functionally important, there's also a divergence excess. So you need to add this divergence excess to the constrained sites to figure out how many functionally important sites are. And what you estimate is that in UTRs, whereas you'd estimate that 60% of sites are functionally constrained, actually, if you add the adaptive fraction to that, it implies that 80% or more of those sites are functionally important. And so that's a feature of the Drosophila genome that it's not going to be as important for introns and intergenic regions, although the point holds that estimates of constraint are biased towards underestimating the functional importance of non-coding DNA. So I've done a little bit of work trying to tackle some of these problems by looking at different classes of sites, for example, different classes of codon changes, trying to control for demographic effects by looking at lineage-specific patterns instead of comparing two species that might have different population sizes, these problems that I outlined there. But at the end of the day, really, I think this is the real killer for McDonald-Kriemann test, is that we can't do much about this. And